Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Barling and Barrett. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'm joined by my good friend, veteran trial lawyer Manny Barling. Manny, good afternoon.
Hey, Simon, how are you?
I'm doing just great, and I know that we have some guests. You want to introduce a couple of the reprobates?
Well, yes, ladies and gentlemen, we have more guests than Oprah does in a week. I tried to describe it as a round table, but we're not sure, so you better get your seatbelts on. And one corner we have to the right, Sam Moffey, who's the heavyweight champion of Poland, Ohio, bringing us a viewpoint of conservatives versus liberals in Ohio. We have John Perry sitting to his right, probably about two chairs deeper into the right than him, with views that I can't even describe. But John, who's got a degree from McKenna in economics, always backs it up with a quote from Stalin. And for those of us in America, a quote from Stalin? John, you should be ashamed of yourself. And on the right, John, we're going to get to your question. On the right, we have Peter Haven, who doesn't, or I should say on the left these days, who doesn't know he's on the left. So, Peter, you're going to have to shift some of your views so you can support those poor people on the left who need a lawyer to represent them. And me, I switch sides faster than anyone you can imagine. So you can expect some right, some left, some middle, and some other views, because I don't know where I stand. I don't know who I'm going to vote for, and I'm not even sure what I'm going to support. So if Ashley's joining us, she leans a little more to the left and supports the importance of the individual over government. And Simon, you're British, so we don't know what the hell you support. What do you support, Simon?
Hey, I have no clue. I hate them all.
So I was beseeched to allow John Perry to ask one question, and if it's not a good one, John, it's the last question you get to ask on the show. So what is it?
And understand, John, I am in control of the switchboard.
Simon, I always allow you the luxury of being mistaken. First of all, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you today for allowing me to be on with my favorite talk show host. Unfortunately, Dennis Prager wasn't available, so I'm here with you, Simon. I had a challenge for you, Manny. I'm willing to wager lunch on it. Think carefully. I'm willing to bet that you cannot go the duration of the show, the next 90-odd minutes, without mentioning the greatest president of the 21st century, W.
I will get to him in about five words.
So that's an easy bet for me.
It's an easy bet, but I'm not betting you lunch. So, in fact, let me tell you what the show's about, John, because that will help you going it.
Before you do that, I think it's only fair to warn our viewing audience, in the interest of listener safety, I suggest that you fasten your seatbelts. Make sure that your seats and tray tables are in the upright and locked position, because I know Manny is loaded for bear.
Yes. The Surgeon General tried to write a warning, but he just couldn't get one good enough for the show. Because this is round two in the true heavyweight championship fight in the United States. Obamacare and the 212 election and all the other issues that are attached to it. And to give everybody, our listeners, some background to where we're going and some basis of this argument, my humble opinion is that this country is divided along lines very similar to the pre-Civil War period of our history from 1830 to 1860. About 25% of the country is very conservative, consisting of fundamentalist Christians and the Tea Party. About 35% is very liberal, and they're often accused of being socialists by the other side. And the other 40% are basically independents capable of voting for either party, depending on the issues. Flip-floppers, if you want to call them, not committed to any ideal and certainly not in agreement with the other two. In 1980, the 40% shifted in favor of Ronald Reagan and stayed in his corner for two terms. In 1992, the 40%, unhappy with George Bush's statement of no new taxes, abandoned the Republican Party, and they supported Bill Clinton for two terms. In 2000, just enough of the 40% shifted its support to G.W. Bush, there goes my bet, to help him win a close, disputed election. After two Bush administrations, the 40% again abandoned the Republican Party and massed his support to President Obama. Well, at some point, the respective sides saw this fight as a control over the country and realized that control really rests with Congress and not the president. Congress, as a result, is now where presidential policies can die with just a few votes, sometimes even one vote. That battle, now fueled by the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United, which gives corporations and political action committees, PACs as we call them, unlimited power to influence politics through massive donations. It has changed the battlefield to the floor of Congress. As a result, the race for president has less meaning than ever because whoever wins the majority positions in Congress will thwart the efforts of a president from the opposing party, Democrat and Republican alike. This is clearly evidenced by the fight over health care. So at some point, it doesn't matter who the president of the United States is because his office is being rendered politically impotent by Congress. But Congress is now controlled by the unholy trinity of American politics. What is the unholy trilogy? Corrupt Congress, corrupt multinational corporations, and corrupt university systems. I know Sam and others might add corrupt labor. Well, we'll get to that one, too. The three have become a form of corporate octopus controlling this country like robber barons of the last 1880s. The next great bubble is a $3 million or $3 trillion debt for tuition paid to greedy universities that are using Congress to suck money out for the income of, as income from the public treasury. If Congress were not giving out loans, tuition would drop drastically and Americans could once again afford an education. Tuition today is directly tied to the current amount of loans and grants students qualify for. Forgiving the tuition debt will only add to our national debt, so it's a major issue. If we do not cure our educational system and improve the health of America, the United States will no longer be competitive in world markets. The eternal question facing America and all these programs in Obamacare is whether to trust Congress and the White House to administer health or trust the greedy multinational corporations and universities to treat Americans fairly instead of like cattle or laboratory rats. Why am I including education? And why is the panel going to discuss it? They become because the universities have become a greedy cloud of self-righteousness, as if they're the keepers of America's integrity, when in fact they're deceitful, they defend the system at all costs. Administrators who are increasingly receiving high six- and seven-figure salaries no longer qualify as educators. So what does this have to do with all this, and what does it have to do with this week's story, Jerry Sandusky? Well, he was a highly paid, including $168,000 severance package educator when he retired under a cloud of suspicion over a sexual allegation in 1998. He was paid to retire by the university and permitted to continue while officials worried about tarnishing the name of Penn State and pro football, or should say, and it really was pro football, including Joe Paterno, because when you look at the dollars, it is professional. How bad was it? Well, Joe Paterno showed up late for Sandusky's retirement party and left approximately 50 minutes later. Apparently, Paterno knew something he should have disclosed. But the bigger picture is that this bastion of public ethics was willing to lie to cover up a heinous crime to keep its good name untarnished by publicity. So let's take a look at this, guys. Does it really matter who's president of the United States if Congress is corrupt, accepting bribes? It's only disguised as campaign contributions and sweetheart deals like those offered by countrywide loans are going on every day. And how can we trust our universities when even the blind can see that administrators have turned into self-righteous demigods with bloated salaries and unlimited perks from multinational corporations? So, Simon, you better save me. Find something to answer a question here.
I was enjoying it. I thought you were just getting into your stride.
Oh, well, I could do an hour more than that, you know? I mean, and how can we trust a medical survey from a university whose largest donors are the ones for whom they write these surveys, the same ones who use, you know, Citizens United to bribe the FDA and Congress?
Well, okay, Manny, you have opened up a dozen different discussions with your diatribe. I'm just going to pick one minor little bit. John, Manny touched on the Penn State scandal. I mean, you know, that's something I can wrap my head around. I'm wondering if you...
Simon, this is a family show.
I'm wondering if you've read the Louis Freeh report, or you know, if you have any thoughts on the sound bites that are turning up on the TV news.
I'm glad you asked that, Simon. Very insightful question. Let me just cover a few bases, and then everyone else can respond. As far as Louis Freeh, I would feel more confident in an investigation conducted by World B. Freeh, because Louis B. Freeh has always been known for self-promotion and aggrandizement when he was FBI director. Secondly, Manny, you're presenting a false choice between corporations and the government. I think doctors should be involved in determining patients' care. And also, you may have missed it, but Obama has instituted more executive orders as far as appointments of czars, NLRB representatives, numerous other laws that were supposed to be passed by Congress, like gay marriage and immigration. He just passes over Congress now and rules by fiat, like Louis the 16th. So you might want to look into the executive order aspect, Manny, because it seems to me Congress is irrelevant with Obama in office.
I thought Louis the 16th was a piece of furniture.
That's beyond my pay grade.
You know, Peter, you were kind enough to send me a copy of the Freeh report, which I deeply appreciate. So we're going to give you first shot to respond to some of John's stuff here. You ready to go?
Well, I'm just thinking back to the days of World B. Freeh. I thought that was awesome.
That's right. Yeah. Great shot.
Oh, boy. I don't know where to begin. And I didn't get through the entire Freeh report. I read portions of it. It seemed to me that it was a pretty balanced approach to trying to investigate the facts. It read like a legal indictment. And I don't, I couldn't perceive any bias in the report. That's not to say that it wasn't there. But, you know, I hardly know where to begin. It's been my experience that when corporations and entities have an opportunity to make money or expose themselves to criticism and embarrassment, that they almost always choose the option of making money, and that it's very hard to get people in systems to corporate systems or any kind of system. It's very hard to get them to make the kind of tough choices that need to be made in a lot of those circumstances. And hiring the FBI investigator to investigate the university by the university hiring him themselves, I thought was a good step. They're policing themselves and they're ferreting out their own improper conduct. I have no idea how bad it's going to get for them as a result.
Right, and that is an important comment to make. I read it, and I slogged my way through it all, but I'm like that. And it was a pretty damning report. And what bothers me in some ways, I won't say bothers me, but you know, that it's a bit of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you know, Penn State are, being transparent, being open, and being honest. And on the other hand, they're opening themselves up for a whole world of civil hurt.
Well, as I pointed out, and I wanted to point out something quickly. I believe, and Peter probably agreed with me, that this was going to come out some way or another, and that putting their head under the rock was not going to get them away from the reality of this situation. So I felt they made a decision they would do it before somebody forced them to do it, or someone that they did it that they didn't want to do it. And Peter, do you have any different feeling about that?
No, I was just I think there's a large I think that's very true. I think they realized that there were going to be a lot of bad facts, and that the classic thing that we're all taught in lawyering is if you've got a bad fact, you want to be the one to disclose it because it's far better if you bring it up than the other side.
Right.
And so they're doing, in my opinion, a very commendable job of really policing themselves. And that is very hard to do. By the same token, I also think that when you have institutions, the people who make the decision to undertake this kind of investigation, for the most part, are not the same people who are going to be named in the crosshairs by the results of the investigation. The university generally is going to be taken to task for it, but the real brunt of the wrongdoing will be, you know, pinned down on four or five individuals, and those individuals are all gone. And yes, they are opening up themselves to civil liability, but they don't have any choice in that regard. They're already on the hook, and it's just a question of how much they're going to have to pay to settle all those things.
Sam, you're close geographically, Ohio, so you're the closest guy there. Do you get the benefit of any local articles of people that are closer to the situation?
No, it's a combination of he's still Joe Paterno. We talked about this last week with look what happened when Jim Tressel was involved with this the scandal at Ohio State,
right.
which was a lot worse than people want to say, because we live in a world now. And I'm going to throw another segment out that when you were in your opening monologue, Manny, attacking rightfully so a lot of them. You left out the media. One of the reasons our country's in bad shape is because we don't have reporters, we have repeaters. And we have repeaters who want to get tickets to the football games. They want to go out to dinner. They want to rub elbows with the rich and the powerful and whatnot. Go to those White House dinners, which are just absolute jokes. And the president gets up there, and you know, in the White House press corps, and them are bantering. And I mean, there's no what's the word I'm looking for. They're all together now. They're all holding hands, singing "Kumbaya." They rip us all off, and as we fall off the edge of the cliff, because they're all living totally different than we are, and. Totally out of touch with what's happening, and I find that with Penn State, it's like they want. It's almost like the local reporters and whatnot. They want. They'll just get the stories off the AP, pick and choose what they want, and there's no real in-depth discussion about what's going on. It almost reminds me of the Catholic Church situation. Everyone knew what happened. There was monies paid out, and everyone knew it was going to be big monies paid out, but there was never really. Exposed the way it should have been, and people really punished, and the church really punished for what they allowed to do. There's been bits and pieces of it, depending on where it happened, but nothing. I expect once football season to start, and Penn State's playing Ohio State at Happy Valley, there'll be 150,000 screaming maniacs there, and the only thing people will care about is what the score of the game is, and not what really happened. How the school covered it up and all that. And I'm, you're talking about the student loans, Manny, and I'm going to tell you, I think whoever the next president is, they're going to have to forgive them, and they're going to have to get rid of that program. And they're going to have to bring the cost of college down, and they're going to have to stop paying football coaches $7 million a year, and they're going to have to start using that their sports money to offer scholarships to people and really teach kids.
Yeah, well, I believe if Romney wins, I can assure you that will not happen. And I don't think Obama or any president on the other side would be capable to carry it off. And by the way, I did not intend to leave the media exempt from all this, but we've got 12 to 15 more weeks, so we're going to be doing 12 to 15 more shows, and I promise you we're going to focus in on them pretty sharply at some point.
So. Yeah, I don't think Romney wants to do it. I don't think Obama. I mean, it's money right to the government. You know, I mean, the banks don't loan school loans anymore.
And
I think it was really horrible.
Okay.
I've been listening to you guys, and I think that one of the problems is getting around to the fact that here you've got, let's just take Romney, not to pick on him, because both guys on both sides of the fence here, Romney's taking $100 million this month from lobbyists. He's got corporations and lobbyists and people that are backing him. What do you think you got to give back when you take that much money?
Oh, agreed. I mean, look, at your local, forget about the national level, at local level in my little township of Poland, where the job pays $3,000 a year part-time to be a councilmen or people raise $30,000-$40,000 to run for office. You know,
yeah.
For what? You know, but why? There's contracts.
And as a point of reference, $40,000 buys you a home in Poland, if I'm not mistaken, because I know it can buy an awfully nice home
in
Yemen.
Maybe not in Poland. But in other places it does. But no, you know, but so it's the same thing. I mean, why are we shocked at how much money they're raising? And as you said, what do they have to give? And that is a great question. And I think we all know what it is. They give back oodles and oodles.
Right. I mean, what do they have to commit to? I mean, you've got lobbyists who are making. I pulled up a list this morning, and I was showing it to Manny because it just irks the heck out of me. The first lobbyist on the list, there's a thing called top compensation. There's a guy called Lynn McComb on the top of the list. Okay, there's 50 of them. He has made so far this year, in 2012, $222,386.90. That's only, you know. This is only part of the year. And according to what I'm reading, the lobbyists do not have to fully disclose. So this is a man who's made this much money so far and is lobbying doing what? You know, and he switched positions, so it gets back to our healthcare situation, because he switched positions is working with a hospital. So it's like he's working with a big hospital association, and here's this guy making all this money. Who's beholden?
Right. And by the way, for those listeners who heard this voice unintroduced out of the dark, it's my wife, Ashley F. Brooks, who's also a co-author of 4 books with me, who apparently has some strong feelings about this. And Ashley, by the way, is from Youngstown, Ohio, too, although Sam and Ashley are not cousins like most of the other people in the region.
We could be, though. We just don't know yet.
Finally,
it is Youngstown, right, Sam?
And if they are, their families aren't talking.
That's right.
Peter, before we drift off into what is obviously going to become a highly political conversation, I just want to go back to the whole Penn State thing for a second. Schultz and Curley are charged with perjury. And I was reading a rather interesting New York Times article this morning. The writer pointed out that perjury is actually quite a difficult charge to make stick in court. Because you forget something does not imply guilt necessarily. Do you think that they'll be able to succeed in sticking Curley and Schultz with a guilty finding?
Well, let me offer a thought, and then we probably ought to hear from Peter on this. There are several different forms of perjury. Perjury in open court before a judge is usually the one that's punished the most because the judge can hear it and assess and determine for himself whether he feels somebody's lying, even if they say they don't remember. Now, when it comes to the kind of issues that you're talking about, I think the situation is slightly different. It breaks down into two categories. One of them is perjury before the grand jury, and the other one is the classic perjury to the FBI, for example, which is what we saw in the Martha Stewart case. So in this particular case, this kind of perjury to a grand jury is usually treated with far more commitment by the prosecutors and will be pushed a lot harder because it goes to the heart of the system. And when the grand jury system is not working adequately within a state, then, of course, they feel that the entire system is failing. So they're going to do everything they can to uphold the grand jury position from a legal standpoint, more so than they would a different kind of perjury. Do you disagree with that, Peter?
No, I agree with that. And I'm glad, Simon, that you talked about the difficulty of proving perjury. You know, I often interact with people and they make a misstatement and you point out to them they made a misstatement or they catch it themselves and they joke and they say, oh, I lied. I didn't mean that. And oftentimes people think that if you say something that's incorrect under oath that you've lied, you've committed perjury. And the reality is it's a very different thing. People often make mistakes and things of that nature, and that doesn't amount to perjury. Now, what we're, perjury is knowing and intentionally telling a falsehood under oath. And with respect to, and perjury is a very difficult thing to prove, but in this particular instance, I think they have a lot of evidence of perjury because these guys essentially testified to the grand jury that they didn't know anything about these allegations or this incident in the shower. And they have some pretty, I think, strong evidence from McQuarrie that indicated that he reported it the next day and that Paterno himself reported it on up the chain. And it's just highly unlikely to think that these facts weren't, in a very short time period, sort of communicated like wildfire up and down the pertinent hierarchy at Penn State. So generally speaking, perjury is difficult to prove, very difficult to prove. But in this case, I think they've got a good chance at it because it's just unreasonable to think that the events that were witnessed weren't reported immediately in the manner that McQuarrie said they were.
Right.
Well, let me throw in something, Peter. If you, if Simon, I read through probably a little more than you did. Unlike Simon, Peter and I have a life. We can't read 500 pages of legal briefs and this report and over the weekend. So I'm defending Peter for not finishing because I couldn't either. But
I thank you for that.
You go to page 23 of the report, it lays out facts at different periods. And in the first 30 pages, you can pretty well get the gist of this. But on page 23, they cite this whole discussion that you brought up about McQuarrie reporting. And it turns out, and they're quoting from the emails, he waited until Monday to report it because, quote, Paterno didn't want to interfere with their weekends. So on February 11th, Schultz consults with the university outside counsel, and a quote from an email, Ray reporting suspected child abuse. On Monday, Spanier, Schultz, Curley meet to discuss a situation that he describes as unique and a heads-up meeting in emails, okay? So they have Schultz's confidential notes that indicate he spoke to Curley, reviewed the history of the 98 incident, and agreed that Curley would discuss the incident with Paterno and recommend that Curley meet with Sandusky. Okay, and then Schultz's note states, quote, unless he confesses to having a problem, Curley will indicate we need to have the Department of Public Welfare review the matter as an independent agency concerned with child welfare. And then there's an email where Schultz asks the chief of police, Harmon, if he still has a copy of the incidents. And then there's another email there that talks about they meet and devise a plan of action, and they one of them is three, tell the chair of the board of Second Mile. One is report to the Department of Welfare, and the next one is tell Jerry Sandusky to avoid bringing children along in the Lash Building. And the plan is confirmed in a subsequent email from Schultz to Curley. So we're talking, and then it goes on. There's about several other emails. So this is, then they go on this whole email where we talk about we're going to talk him into professional help. If he's cooperative, we'll work with him to handle informing Second Mile. If Sandusky doesn't cooperate, we don't have a choice. We'll inform the DPW, Department of Welfare, and Second Mile. Additionally, I'll let him know that his guests are not permitted to use our facilities. So there's, I mean, I didn't give the total number, but there's a huge number of emails going from January until March where all this goes on, including an email that says essentially that Paterno met with Paterno and that they wanted to give him a chance and didn't want to report it. And this is what Curley, Spanier emails to Curley and Schultz, and it is so telling. This approach is acceptable to me. Then he adds, the only downside for us is that the message isn't heard and acted upon, and we then become vulnerable for not having reported it. But that can be assessed down the road. The approach you outline is humane and a reasonable way to succeed. And then he talks about this being more humane, and we can play it by ear. And to me, there are just so many emails like this. I don't know how either one of them can say they don't know, Peter. And I'll go to the two non-lawyers here, first to John and then to Sam. John, do you think you can avoid these kind of emails? I mean, they're pretty damning, aren't they?
Well, I'd like to say this, Manny. I didn't get to the report by World B. But I'm waiting for the NC2A investigation. because they persecuted my favorite coach of all time, Jerry Tarkanian, and hounded him out of the profession. And they're quite possibly the only organization or body who can compete with the executive branch in terms of incompetence and ineptness. So let's wait for their report.
Yeah, well, I presume that will be, since it's a Midwestern school in Penn State, much like Ohio State, you will not hear very much
about
it.
Yeah, look what they did. Look what they did to Tark, who gave kids a shot that no one else would.
I thought Tarkanian was unjustly treated, but the simple fact is they had to pay $1 million in settlement from the litigation.
But it took like 20 years, man.
I realized that.
Him out of the game. I know. I think it was $2 million.
Was it two? I knew it was two.
Well,
that number. And yes, the fact is the NC2A, National Collegiate Athletic Association, is the most arbitrary good old boy system and the most dishonest system I've seen in the United States. They're self-aggrandizement is only evidenced by the amount of perks they get at bowl games, cars, rooms, and even the nerve of them. I mean, in the case of one of the bowl games in Arizona, as we've discussed before, they've used these charitable monies to finance politicians and support their goals, which is why I included a corrupt university system in my opening discussions. And Sam, you're in the hotbed of football and the hotbed of football cover up, where if you say one word against Ohio State, you can find a bomb on your front porch.
Oh, it's getting worse. It's getting worse. It's even filtered down to the high school level now too. I mean, I'm in the hotbed of high school football.
Oh, absolutely.
And we've got high school teams now playing in professional stadiums with all sorts of boosters behind them. There's open recruiting going on. It's a nightmare, but it's how much money it brings in even now to the public schools. And it's terrible. I mean, believe me, I love sports. My kids played. They won state championships. We had a lot of fun as a parent being involved. It's a great thing to see your sons compete and win a state championship, meet friends and all that. And winning Ohio State football champion is pretty tough thing to do. But you sit there, and that now that my kids are all grown and gone, and you see how the high school corruption is just like they're like mini colleges, and how they recruit kids and get things and give the parents jobs. You know, these are at the private schools, and at the public schools they do a thing now called open enrollment, and to get all the kids out of the inner city to come into the suburbs to play ball, and it's bad. And I think you're right. I think the NCAA will rule on the Penn State thing probably in 150 years. It's going to take them forever to do it. They're going to hope that it goes away, and they're going to hope that they can write these checks to the poor victims, and everything's okay, and they can go back to, Happy Valley again. And that's what they want, because the university, just like Washington, Manny, I can't disagree with you. Penn State and what they did there and the cover-up and the amount of money that comes in and the two guys who knew about it, the emails you were talking about, that's not the type of men and women we want in leadership positions at university or any institution. When wrongdoing comes up, these men and women are supposed to do the right thing, not cover it up for the sake of more money. That's the society we live in now.
Ashley, I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. I know that you have gone back to school, and I commend you for that.
Oh, thank you.
I think it's an excellent thing for you to do. Why is it so damned expensive? I'm listening to John. I'm listening to Manny. I'm listening to Sam, and they're all saying the same thing. You know, these universities have lots of money. You know, they're all involved in quote, professional sports, right? Even though, it's actually amateur. Why is tuition so much?
I really can't even explain it. It is so offensive that, and every time you try to ask the financial department of these schools, can you explain this or this or this on the bill, they'll shine you on, and then you'll talk to the person above them, and they'll shine you on, and everybody has a script as to where they're spending the money, and they will take your money and then say, too bad. I mean, it's really, I have been so disillusioned by school and so disappointed with school that it's completely changed from when I went to school. And it's really, the universities have changed, and it's sad. And it's sad about the greed. And they'll promise one thing, and then the next month they'll say, oh, gee, you know, this particular school, oh, gee, you know, we promised you this, but we decided not, because now that we have everybody's money, we opened a new school, and we're not going to promise you, we're not going to give you that, even though we promised it. Oh, well, we can do that. We can change it at any time.
Let me add something to this, too. You know, we were you brought up the subject, and we joke about the professional nature of college sports. I will take, for example, my favorite school, University of Southern California. They bring in about $80 million a year from their football program alone. They pay for every other sport on campus out of football, okay? So there would be no Title IX sports in most universities without the dollars coming from there. Very few college basketball teams make money, believe it or not. Their money comes from the tournaments, from the, you know, from March Madness, as everybody refers to it. So what we have is a situation where this is now becoming the wagon pulling not only that, but donations, because most donations come to the university by way of the football team. If you look at T. Boone Pickens, the well-known American merger specialist, and I'm going to use that as a kind description of him, he donated $250 million to Oklahoma State to advance their football team and then build an entire new division and wing onto the school that was one was supposed to be for the benefit of all the students, but essentially is a gift to the football team. This is what goes on. So without a football team that's prospering, the donations to the university go down. Sometimes they're as high as $200 to $300 million a year as a result of the ongoing success of football teams. The University of Alabama could not support itself without a football team.
Yeah, but yet the players receive nothing, right, Manny?
Right. And yet they fight over whether or not they want to pay a stipend to an athlete because it's too much money.
Who could be hurt or injured or destroyed the rest of their body, could be destroyed the rest of
their
life.
Yeah, the athlete's getting a full ride.
Right. He's getting a full ride for school, but still compared to what that school's making. That school's making a lot of money. And if they accept isn't a dinner out with somebody considered a gift?
Well, all of those things are banned under college.
So you can't even accept a dinner out.
Essentially, and I'm sure our sports fans know this, everything that management, namely administrators, do in the operation of the university, that they accept the money they accept, if a player did it, he would be thrown out of football.
But, Manny, one of the questions I have is, now, USC, this may be a discussion that I missed, I hope not. The USC, something happened, USC wasn't allowed to do X, Y, Z for 2 years. Is that going to happen to Penn State?
Well, that's the interesting one, because when you look at the level of crime involved, if there's anybody who should have some type of extreme penalty from the NCAA, it certainly should be Penn State for lack of institutional control. And if I've ever seen lack of institutional control, we're seeing it right now at Penn State. But the argument Penn State and the rest are making is, oh, this isn't football related. Oh, really?
I'm sorry. Raping a little boy in a locker room is not Penn State related?
Right. And allowing this to happen by allowing access to them, they do not consider a football issue.
And if
I might point out, and you can jump into this one, Peter, I believe if you read the last published article that Paterno was going to publish saying that it shouldn't take to Penn State football, what a few people accidentally did, or whatever the words he used were. I mean, that's horrendous. That's like it's further evidencing how lost he was on these key issues.
There's no question that what happened was, in my opinion, directly related to football. It couldn't have happened but for football, and the football there enabled it, no doubt about it. The problem becomes, what's the NCAA's job, and what's their what's their jurisdiction, so to speak, and what rights, you know, what rules and regulations are in place. And I just don't think the NCAA ever conceived of ever having to deal with a situation like this. I think they view themselves and they've become a enforcement arm to prevent illegal payments and illegal profiting on football programs in all sports. And, you know, substance abuse violations when connected to athletics and things like that. I don't think there's anything in the NCAA rules, regulations, or bylaws that that really play well into their ability to handle this. They may still try to do it, but whatever they try to impose in the way of a death penalty or a long-term sanction, depending on how severe it is, Penn State will fight it legally, and I don't know how that's going to pan out. I just don't think the NCAA was really ever prepared to deal with anything on the order of magnitude that this is. And the NCAA may say, this is a criminal matter, and we really can't get involved in criminal matters. I just have no idea. It's a very complex problem. It'll be interesting to see how the NCAA does handle it.
Well, my view, and Sam, I want truth on it too, is they did not act on Ohio State. In fact, gave them a free pass to the bowl games, if you recall, until more information came out and the general public started screaming for their scalp because it became clear that Tressel had done so much more. Well, in this case, there's a huge hue and cry and public uproar that I think will severely damage Penn State, or excuse me, damage the NCAA if they don't stand up and do something about it. How do you feel about that?
I think Peter brings up some really good points, too. I mean, I see his, you know, and then yours is too, it's, you know, it morally they should do something, no question about it. But I think listening to Peter make his points, I think you're going to see them not do anything and say, well, the court system took care of it. It was a criminal matter, this and that, that we'll only act if Penn State doesn't do anything. And when Penn State makes the payouts, that's going to be it. And I totally agree with you that the football program and specifically the higher-uppers in the football program enabled the situation to go. But, Simon, I want to answer. You asked a question about the high cost of tuition. I had to ask the two lawyers something. If you get a student loan, you cannot write a discharge from bankruptcy, can you?
No.
Is that correct?
The general rule in bankruptcy is that there are about 13 or 14 categories of debts that cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. And student loans are one category of debt. So the rule is they're non-dischargeable in bankruptcy. That's the rule. But there have been some exceptions to that rule, and in certain circumstances, students have had their debts discharged. But it's what you call a disfavored remedy, and you really have to show extreme hardship in order to get a bankruptcy judge to give you a discharge on a student loan.
Okay, so my youngest son's in grad school, but he had a bunch of friends. They're all in school the last 4 years. I never knew this happened, but when these kids got loans, the Stanford loan, I believe, it doesn't go to the school. It goes directly to the kid. And the kids were buying cars with them. They were and making deals with the university to, you know, have payment plans. And I found this out. The more I asked kids about this who were getting loans, the more they were getting the money. It was directly sent to them. And, of course, they blew it. And then, you know, and they still get more loans as long as they're going to school. It's a crazy program that needs to be ended, and that will bring all the costs down. And you should, and as far as I'm concerned, and maybe I'm wrong, you know, in regards, but when the government is giving the money, because it's not the banks anymore, it's the government, gives the money directly to the kid, bypasses the school, thinking that kid is going to do the right thing with the money, that's pretty foolish. And then, of course, the universities know, hell, we can keep jacking the prices up because the government's going to keep giving loans, and even if a kid goes bankrupt, we still get our money.
That's right. That's one of the biggest problems.
Except I've not seen money dispersed directly to anyone. Have you, Ash?
No, I've not.
Okay. I'll give you a situation which bothers me deeply. The infamous Pell Grant. All right. And I know this for a fact, right? You get given X amount of dollars, but you only spend half of it on tuition and books, and they just cut you a check, and off you go.
No, I have not run across that yet either.
No, that's not true, Ashley. They tried to fund you, and you refused it.
That's true.
Yeah.
But for me, with receiving any grants or any government money, what I discovered was that the university jacked up the price so that instead of saying this is going to cost you $21,000 to complete this part of your graduate degree, they're instead jacked the price up to $32,000, even though they said it's only going to cost you $21,000, and took the Pell Grant. So that's one of the things I'm finding right now, that the university is jacking the price up of the cost of the colleges, and then they're turning around and then leaving you with the loan. So they essentially are taking the Pell Grant.
Right.
Is very illegal, but they're doing it anyway, and there's no way of stopping it, and you can't get an education without it.
Right. John, you've been very quiet. You must just be simmering.
It's rage, Simon, real or feigned.
Spit it out, John.
John, are you still there?
Yeah, did you have a question for me or just want me to opine?
Just rant, you know, the way you usually do.
Oh, well, it's not conforming to standards. Actually, Simon, I wanted to say to you, and I think more than anyone else on the panel, you can relate to me, because I believe that we have a habit of mind that's ironic, which is more developed and nuanced than Europeans, and I read a lot of European literature. So I don't know if you agree with that or not, but I think we're on the same page on a lot of issues.
Yeah.
Which might be lost on other people. I wanted to ask you, Manny, are you positing the argument that, according to the NC2A, Jerry Tarkanian is responsible for the actions of Lloyd Daniels and J.R. Ryder 24/7 and Pete Carroll, Reggie Bush, and his family, but Penn State gets a pass on their coaches' behavior in their own locker rooms?
I'm the one who says, you know, in a penny, in a pound. If you're gonna discipline one, you got to discipline all. And you know how I feel about.
I know you're not a fan of the NC2A. I would just thought you were saying that they really can't control their coaches. This is beyond their scope.
No. My position is completely different. Where I disagree with the NC2A, and let's take my feelings about the U.S.
Oh, let me ask you real quick, too, before I forget. Did you read Bill Plaschke's column today that those idiots put Caltech on probation for 3 years?
I didn't have to. I was already angry when it started.
Anyway.
And do you know why Caltech's on probation?
Yeah, I read the article.
Okay, because I pointed this out to Ashley. We were talking about an issue that she has about dropping classes and being charged with.
Right.
Caltech has probably the longest policy in the United States that you can read a class for 5 weeks and then change. Well, according to the NCAA rules, they decide that if you do that, you're not actually enrolled in that class, so therefore you don't have credits and you lack sufficient credits to maintain your student status.
Right, they can monitor classes to decide their caseload or their
right. And by the way, Harvard has a several-week policy themselves, so this is common among the better schools. And one of the reasons is, guess what? A guy who goes to Caltech can probably switch classes anytime he wants and catch up with anyone. So the end result, they're taking the creme de la creme of our educational system, the people who will one day be putting rockets on Mars and who for a number of years have already been doing that.
Right, just to get in there, you have to be a genius, and they haven't won a basketball game in like 20 years anyway.
Yeah, so for some reason, this becomes an element, you know, of discipline that just, I look at it and go, what is this about? I mean, where are we in our country where we take geniuses and then subject them to the standards of the lowest in our society? And by lowest, I mean students, because essentially they're acting like they're worried that these poor guys may not get sufficient education. And I'm like, excuse me? Who are we talking about here? And that's what bothered you, right, John?
It's appalling and hypocritical.
Yeah.
And like Sam said, it Penn State, this is the most heinous offense one can conceive of. And if they don't receive at least what SMU did, I don't think it's just.
Yeah.
I agree.
And by the way, that's where I disagree with you, Sam, is this didn't happen outside of school like Reggie Bush, which was the cause of USC's sanctions, where his parents were getting a house free in San Diego, 100 and some miles away from Los Angeles, and who's expected to know what's going on? This happened in Penn State's locker rooms, in their showers, in a variety of places, with the knowledge of the coach who knew that Sandusky was a pedophile.
And supposedly there were, it was Wolf Blitzer, I think, who said something, Manny, about the fact that in those reports somewhere, there were two janitors who actually saw the event, saw an event on separate days, and had seen similar events, but were too frightened to tell anybody at the school.
I think one of them got ill or something too, so he couldn't testify.
That's not what happened at all. It's on about page 20 of the somewhere around there in the report, and it was in November of 2000. Okay, before the shower incident, a year, Sandusky, and a janitor observes assault by Sandusky, but does not report the assault for fear that, quote, they'll get rid of all of us. Another janitor concludes that the university will close rank to protect the football program. So out of fear of their jobs, these two guys did not report it, which is next goes to that culture in the football program that one cannot respond or report any kind of incident because we'll be terminated. And that alone should be an NCAA violation. Sam, I mean, that's pretty serious, don't you?
On the property.
I think it's totally serious. I think it's disgusting. I think they should be given the death penalty, okay? And the football program, you know, they should make
an example of them.
At Penn State, it will send shockwaves to the rest of the country, sports programs and whatnot, about they better clean up their acts about everything. So it should happen, but that's the right thing to do for the better good of everything. But I don't think it's going to happen because there's too much money involved with the football, and the NCAA will sweep it under the rugs. They'll kick the can down the road by saying, look, this was already played out in public opinion. They're all wrong. Joe Paterno's dead. The victims all got money. Penn State has set up a special housing, counseling program for them or any other abused children. Second Mile's been collapsed. Sandusky's in jail. We got to play football, gang.
I guarantee you.
Excuse me a second. Wasn't that Ohio State's a position in their case too?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, basically, yeah. But that's what's going to happen. I think because that's just the way it always. That's the way it's about protecting the. It's circling the wagon to protect the system, even though it's a terrible system.
And as you said, Manny, all that money.
It's all about the money. And,
right.
And they're having, as you guys have all pointed out, about the donations and this and that. Their donations have dried up a little bit, and whatnot. And now they've got to reinvent themselves.
Whose donations have dried up a little bit?
Who's what?
I'm sorry, Sam, whose donations dried up a little bit?
Penn State's donations have
I just read that the opposite happened.
I was told the other one did. I stand corrected.
Yeah, they actually had a record donation level last year. So one of the interesting things that's happened is Penn State community seems to be rallying around Penn State, and their donations, they hit the second highest donation level that they ever had last year for the fiscal year that just ended. And they have an endowment now that's astronomical. I mean, they have just a massive amount of money. So for whatever it's worth, it's interesting to see the reaction of a lot of Penn State community members, alumni, people who live there, and they're really rallying strongly around the university. They feel terrible about it, but they're actually flocking to aid the university in any way they can. And that's a very interesting dialectic. I'm not quite sure how that's going to play out either.
Well, I'll give you an example. As you know, Peter, because you're in Los Angeles also, certainly the USC alumni rallied around Lane Kiffin and the team. And if anything, the team is recruiting better and stronger. And it sort of brought out what I would describe as a sense of defiance about what went on in Los Angeles, which, thank God, is not comparable to what went on back there. But, yes, it does bring people out to go, you know, we can't let this get us down, et cetera, et cetera. And they're actually championing Penn State, not deserting them.
You know, the whole thing – I'm sorry, you go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Just really quickly, the whole thing, there were just two thoughts that kept running through my mind as I was reading those parade of articles this week. And one thought was, yeah, I couldn't help but think of Nazi Germany. And all these people just afraid to buck the system, going along with the flow, afraid to rock the boat, and they got sucked into this world, and it just became an institutional part of the world, of their world. And then the other thing I thought of was Waco, and all of those cult members housed in that that barracks where they were housed. When the feds came around and tried to, you know, beat the doors down, the leader of that cult was able to get all the people inside, no matter how mistreated they were. He got all the people inside to galvanize their support towards him and against the evil foe that was trying to break down their doors. And it's just an observation. It's an interesting psychology that takes shape here. And I think it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. I'm not quite sure what will happen with Penn State.
Yeah, and the only comment is I don't think it's a dynamic. I think it's something that's very much a part of the human culture, the same type of thing that's caused the French resistance, the resistance in Normandy in World War II, the Nazis. There's something in the human spirit that makes them stand up. Ashley watched a movie last night called The Black Book, based upon the famous story about Maximilian, what's his name?
Robespierre.
Robespierre, who basically had a black book of everybody he was going to execute and how it played out during the Reign of Terror. And to a great extent, French people, knowing they were going to die the next day in the guillotine, reacted with such a level of defiance, it was unbelievable. And for those of us critical of the French and their policies, that's even shocking.
Yeah, there were a few French folks that lost their heads over that whole deal.
They certainly did.
You know, and that was probably the last brave stand France ever took, but we won't get too deep into that.
Can I finish something first, Simon? What I was going to say, Peter, was there were two things, and this is a response now to what you just said, and the fact that the natural human thing is the territorial imperative, which is protecting that area, which is the animal instinct within every human being, and they will protect their own and their own nest no matter what, and that's about territorial imperative. And the second thing is, when I was watching the woman who was the best friend of Sandusky and his wife, and how she absolutely went into absolute denial, which is also part of it. The natural thing to do is to go into denial. So you've got two issues going on: territorial imperative to protect your own nest, and secondly, total denial, which is an element right now that I think Penn State is in for that community. They have to either deny it or have to realize that they participated in some fashion to being good friends with this guy who their sons and their children were around. So that's part of their survival mode, is protecting that aspect of their psyche.
Yeah.
You know, that's pathetic that this turned into be a fundraising bonanza for Penn State.
It is.
People actually, alumni whatnot, said, oh, we got to rally behind the school. And, you know, I think, Peter, you're right, that Nazi Germany analogy is spot on.
It's their identity. Their identity has been altered by this event. I went to Penn State. I'm a Penn State graduate. I, and now this identity is also damaged. You know, when you go to the extreme of my good buddy, who was somebody I was supporting, is a child rapist.
And a lot of people really liked him.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And it's unclear whether that was a complete act or whether there was some aspect of him that was truly a decent human being. But he was really liked by a lot of people, and a lot of people have a very difficult time accepting what you just described, Ashley. The truth of it all was that he was not what they thought he was at some level.
And you know what's really sad to me, too? One of the aspects that we haven't discussed is the fact that this man is so mentally ill. And here is a man who is mentally ill, that if you had a mentally ill child, they just showed something on the news last night, I think it was, where some mentally ill child was being abused by somebody. Well, here is this man who's mentally ill, and if you don't take care of the mentally ill, that how could they not take care of this mentally ill man? You know, the whole cycle of the whole event.
I'm glad you said that, because there's a part of his behavior that was so open that it was almost like he wanted help.
He did. Here's this guy saying, I'm going to rape a kid in front of everybody in the locker room, and guess what? Can somebody please help me while I'm hurting this child? He was hurting himself. He was hurting his wife. He's hurting his own child at home. You know, here's a man who is mentally ill. He never received the help based on the fact that there was such a big cover-up because of the ego of this particular school, because it's much more important to say, my identity is Penn State. I, me.
So it's just like, it's a basically off the branch of the Catholic Church abuse.
Right.
It's a tree of abuse that starts, the Catholic priest, and now it's the Catholic Church, and right. Now we have the branch known as the Penn State football.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Okay, this brings up a question. I think I already know the answer to it. Louis Free report basically paints Paterno in a less than glowing light. Could civil litigation include Paterno's estate?
Of course it will, and he's got a terrible exposure to damages in this for a great many reasons. Probably the biggest one is that the emails show that he knew and he did not report it, and I believe that under any circumstances you have to consider him a fiduciary, and by a fiduciary I mean someone who's in a special trust relationship with not only the university, but the children and everyone else that's involved in this program. And then as a result, he bears the ultimate responsibility. When the ship sinks, the captain has to prove he's not responsible. And I believe that's where he is, and I believe that's going to be a major portion of it. And I've already heard a couple of the mothers of children who were molested say they despise them and their attitude towards them. And if they feel that way, you can be certain that his estate will be a party in any kind of litigation involving them. Do you disagree, Peter?
No, it's a very interesting question. He will be a quote-unquote key defendant because he was one of the key decision makers at the university during this whole time. So he will be included as a defendant. He will be the person through whom the plaintiffs go after the university. The question of his estate's personal liability is interesting because everything that Paterno did was in the course and scope of his employment, and apparently he did so with the quote-unquote the university's knowledge, including the knowledge of the president and the athletic director. So his estate will be named. He will be named as a defendant, but I still think at the end of the day, it'll be the university writing all the checks, I suspect.
Well, I think that, too. But wait a minute, Peter, I want to come back to legal thought for you quickly. I believe that when he took that moment and assuming that Free is correct and discouraged them from taking action against him, acting in his own self-interest and not the interest of the university, that's where he crossed the line into that gray area that's going to be his undoing over a period of time.
Yeah,
I
agree.
Did anybody else see that? And I don't know what the dates were. I can't remember what I was just online the other day. That after the story broke, he renegotiated a payout package or something too.
Yeah.
Isn't there something going on about that just came out or something? I don't know all the
details. Best time to renegotiate is before before you get out of there.
It was almost like a fraudulent conveyance. You know, I mean, he really kind of knew that. Oh, well, the shit's going to hit the fan. I better get my retirement. I'm going to retire and get more money or something now before this all comes out.
I think, in all honesty, I got the impression he was thinking about trying to take care of his wife and family. I know that may sound crazy, but he was at the same time transferring title in his home solely to his wife's name. Mm-hmm. And maybe he did that so that he could have a place to live and they couldn't take the home away from her, or maybe he did it to make sure that she was okay. I don't know. But he also did that too.
Yeah. I think there's something you should consider, Peter, and that is that he probably was aware he had cancer before it ever hit the news. And that may have been one of the operative reasons in estate planning to get it out of his name. But in terms of averting deaths and the consequences, as you and I know, because you're an expert at it, having chased O.J. Simpson a fair amount, that type of fraudulent transfer doesn't get you out of the lion's den, so to speak. And I believe that would have been the basis of them pursuing him under any circumstances.
Yeah.
So I think he may well have known the end was coming health-wise. And by the way, the package was $3 million if he retired at the end of 2011, forgiving $350,000 in loans, which he didn't really need, and his retirement package, as well as being provided the university's private plane, which if he flew to a game even, let's say at Nebraska, would be $25,000 in fuel one way. And a luxury box at Beaver Stadium, which you know is worth a bloody fortune. So the package was extremely high. But
now the interesting thing is, did he get that? Because he didn't retire. He was fired.
Well, recently in the last 2 weeks, they announced that they gave him basically everything.
Yeah.
Well, but it was renegotiated by the family.
Right.
And it wasn't renegotiated down either.
Well, sort of. They got a different box at Beaver Stadium, and no, the Sanduskies don't have use of the corporate jet.
Yes, well, yay, wonderful.
Okay,
let me
guys,
point
you
out
think they're
getting
the statue? Did the Joe put on the statue go?
I don't know what they're going to do about the statue. I think they're going to do that more cautiously. But I want to raise a point that seems to be lost here. Joe Paterno is a multimillionaire. He's so wealthy, he at various times he's donated $1 million back to the university for a library and a number of other things. You have no idea how much money he has made as a coach of that team over a period of time. And it's consistent with what other coaches make throughout the country. It's a huge amount of money.
Right.
So Paterno was never, ever exposed to any concerns about him not having enough money for his family. Never.
Yeah.
And by the way, do you know what his salary was the last 3 years?
No, around
$3 million plus bonuses. And since both Simon and I have been to Happy Valley, please, can you imagine living in Poland, Ohio, earning that kind of money?
I would live in Poland, Ohio, if I was making that type of money.
Yes, you would, because your family and friends are there. Trust me, you
I'm sure you'll admit that.
Yeah, we're in the 1% of Youngstown, the Mahoning County, which really isn't saying that much.
Are you sure that the pair of you aren't cousins?
We probably are. I'm telling you, we probably are. It became a distant cousin somewhere along the line where I don't know if you have Irish roots anywhere in you, Sam, but the Irish somewhere had a fight, and somehow we got disconnected. That's the way it works in Ohio.
So anyway, John, coming back to all this, you and I have long discussions about the state of college athletics and how universities now are funding everything. And the ones that bother me the most, because they're in keeping with this discussion, is the perks they give to these administrators to go to sporting events, whether it's a Rose Bowl or whatever. And what's happened is corporate America, who provides these perks, are participating in almost their own form of bribery, and that bribery shows up in twisted medical research and a variety of other things that I think also corrupt our system, because now we're reaching a point where you can't believe anything that comes out of the university in terms of their medical research, which means that these issues are now telescoping across the entire university. Do you see any of that yourself?
Well, I think just it's endemic in society. People have an overall contempt for our national institutions and distrust the law because of things like this. And I wanted to say, Simon, I was really impressed that you had a thought. That's a newfound and commendable innovation I encourage you to pursue.
John, are there any news for you?
John, I always enjoyed talking to you.
We got to do this more often, Simon.
All right, Ashley, Manny brought the subject up, but you are more closely connected with it. I'm greatly bothered by the fact that the universities are also getting gobs and gobs of money from big pharma and big agriculture. These huge grants to essentially doctor papers. I mean, does that aspect bother you?
Well, Ashley, perhaps you should explain to our listeners a little more about the background of that.
Why don't you, Manny? You're great at that.
Oh, okay, please. I'm sorry now that I jumped in.
Thank you.
Yeah, you opened your mouth.
I think my wife just punted. It's only third down, folks.
That's because my husband's brilliant.
Oh, stop it. Basically, Ash and I, in our books, have chronicled a long history of taking reports, universities, and essentially writing what they need to satisfy the corporate donor. Harvard is probably the worst. We cite in our books, I think it was over 1,800 Harvard professors had accepted some type of gratuity or a bribe from a drug company. And we're just covering the medical school. We haven't even got to the other areas. And when you have that kind of situation, that much bribery is going around, it's pretty hard for anybody to rely on what these people are saying. So, Ashley, you want to take it from there?
Well, the one example I think right now is which really made me chuckle. Monsanto is one of the bigger donors, along with, you've got ConAgra and various people that are going in and donating massive amount of money to every school so that they are influencing what is being taught at that school by their money. So one of the kids that, of course, they have, Monsanto does the biotech things, and so within the last couple months, some kid at one of the schools decided to run an experiment on the tomato, which is a genetically modified tomato, Monsanto, and they discovered that it altered the gene, that altered the proteins, that altered things within the tomato without getting into the drastic bacteria and viruses. And what happened is they're actually countering everything they're not supposed to say because that school is paid by Monsanto. You can't say anything. So everything is limited, and their schooling is limited. I mean, I'm finding that even right now at the school I'm in, everything is limited on you're only supposed to read evidence-based based on and all the materials coming from, various places that are pharmaceutical companies are, investing. And again, like ConAgra and Monsanto, and these people are paying these scientists that turn around that give materials that are not, they're not 100%. It's not independent testing.
Well, why don't you just paint it for what it is? They have an agenda, and that agenda very clearly is to advance the interests of the drug companies. They make no effort to be objective. And then when you read some of these tests, they have these huge proclamations, and you find out they only tested like 10 people across the United States that support the ridiculous
Oh, I've seen one or two. We're basing this on two people. What do you mean? This is across the board when you're doing it on two people. It's absolutely ridiculous. And they're paying the schools.
Okay.
Oh, and recently they had somebody on CNN who was coming in to speak about, she was a nutritionist, big nutritionist coming in and went into one of the CNN news people through her kitchen to see what was good and bad in the kitchen. Now, I can say whatever school she went to, it was backed by the Corn Refineries Association. And how do I know that? Because she went into her kitchen, overlooked all the sugar, and then proceeded to say sugar is sugar, which we know FDA even says sugar is not sugar. So here's a nutritionist going in and telling people on national news what she has been, the propaganda taught to her by the company that has paid her school, her nutrition school, to say what she is now repeating.
So does that upset you, Simon? Your girlfriend, Andrew Walker at the Corn Refiners Association, done it again.
Boy, she gets everywhere.
Yeah, Simon's had a long-running battle in his articles with her about what sugar is and sugar isn't sugar, and frankly embarrass him so much they stop talking to him and don't respond to anything, which I find hysterically funny. I mean, Simon, you offended them right out of the marketplace.
But I have invited her several times to take part in a discussion, but unfortunately she's always on a sugar high and just can't fit me into her busy schedule.
You know, I love it that we're talking about sugar and foods, because that's one of my big pet peeves. But dealing with the manufacturers and the food suppliers is really only half the problem. The equal problem, if not greater, is the fact that people want their sugar in their food. And if you take it out, they get very upset. And I don't know to what degree they're thinking about things as being manipulated by these companies that are supplying them, but the biggest problem is this: just the demand for it. People want it. And you can't,
Simon,
you can't
you
get
have told Ashley and I back.
Yeah, really. And right now, oh, gosh, there's just so much. The problem is the biggest problem is that people think that they're eating sugar, and when they're not eating sugar, they're eating a synthetic manufactured in a lab from corn, which is manufactured in a lab, and so they're having a synthetic sugar that is making them ill.
Peter, let me offer you a thought. When you have a chance, go to our site, howtoeliminatepain.com, or pick up one of our books. We not only analyze this, we give you the actual sugar count in every soft drink and everything you'll find on the market. We list every single product, and I tell you, you're going to be shocked at what we contain in our books, because first of all, sugar is adulterated. It's refined and bleached, and then they put aluminum sulfonate, I believe it's pronounced, into it to make sure it doesn't in any way cake. Remember the old days when you're young and sugar would cake, and so would salt inside a shaker, and they put a saltine cracker in there. Remember those days? Well,
I remember that.
Yeah, well, what they did to get rid of that was to add this aluminum base in it, which is totally unhealthy. And what it does, essentially, is cause people to eat aluminum, and it's mercury.
Yeah, oh, it's aluminum and mercury. You're
right. And at the end of the day, that's unhealthy if you use sugar that is what we call organic sugar, which is unrefined sugar. Then unrefined sugar, conversely, has about 80 or 90 different vitamins and minerals in it. It is far healthier and doesn't cause you to gain weight because the human body rejects the other one. So, Simon, save us from that, because we're no longer doing it.
Okay.
I know, but
what I'm going to do is I'm going to switch gears completely. I think it's time to rile John and Sam up. All right. I have this Sunday morning routine. I stumble out of bed, put on the coffee, and I watch State of the Nation with Candy Crowley at 8 a.m., GPS with Fareed Zakarian at 9, and Reliable Sources with Howard Kurtz at 10. Now, I have to admit that my favorite is Fareed. He doesn't tend to play very much in American politics. He just wants to fix the world. Crowley and Kurtz, on the other hand, live and breathe it. Boy, they were rough on Mitt Romney this morning. Of course, it's been a rough week all round for Mitt. I mean, he could be named the Mittney Liar. He was booed at the NAACP meeting.
Gee, what a surprise!
He has the ongoing Bain Capital debacle, and he gave five very defensive interviews on Friday. John, is he on the ropes?
I don't even think I was talking to Manny earlier. We were just touching on the subject before we all gathered for the round table. And I don't even know why he even responded to the Bain attacks. But he did. Obviously, they must have made a dent in the poll or something and whatnot. And by the way, I supported Ron Paul, okay? I did not support Mitt Romney at first. I don't support the libertarian philosophy, especially given how crazy government has gotten and career politicians and lobbyists and all that sort of stuff. But Romney is, you know, he went to the NAACP and they booed him. I thought it was one of his best moments because he didn't pander to them. And, you know, in regards to that, you know, I'm sick of politicians who pander, and I was happy that Romney didn't. He told them what he believed and what he was going to do, and, you know, of course they booed him. I mean, they booed John McCain, they booed George Bush, they'll boo anybody else. I mean, I could have went as Obama's representative, and I would have been cheered. You know, I mean, that's just the way that goes, you know. But as far as the Bain goes, the Bain, for some reason, you know, you go to all the websites. I go to realclearpolitics.com, not to give anybody away some Simon stuff. And it's kind of, and it you know, has a mixture of all right, left, center, libertarian, socialist, Marxist, from all over the country. You can pick and click what you want to read. And I read from all over and look at the polls and all that stuff. And the Bain attack is the part of the class warfare. He's rich. He wants to make the rich richer, the poor poorer, and you can only trust us with your money. Well, I want to give you an example about trusting Barack Obama with your money. I own a bar, as the listening audience knows, and the people on the panel know, and I just found out the other day that with the stimulus money for the shovel-ready projects that were supposed to happen around the country, our esteemed president, acting through the democratically controlled Congress, the democratically controlled county of Mahoning County, the democratically controlled city of Youngstown, gave $25,000 to a bar, one bar, and under the stimulus money, because the guy was in danger of going out of business. And they gave him $25,000, have it all documented and all that sort of stuff. And that's shocking to me that they can pick, that the winners, that the government is now picking winners and losers all the way down to the local level of what bar they're going to help out. And that's not good. That's not the type of government that I want to see. And I hope that it has to change, and it has to be changed in November, or it's going to get worse. They're going to keep taking money from all of us, and they're going to pick who gets it.
I'm with you, Sam.
It's never going to be the right people to get the money. It's going to be those who are connected and have the friends and relatives in high places.
And I agree with you completely. I don't support that either.
Yeah, but
okay,
we're
John,
still stuck with 100. We're still stuck with those people who, you know, all those people that just gave $100 million in 1 month to one candidate.
No, and I agree with you. And look,
so who do you vote for?
The big money was behind Obama, right?
Pardon?
In 2008, the big money was behind Obama. I mean, he raised 20 times more than John McCain did. All the big money was, now the big money, you know, is behind Romney. I mean, and it's now legal because of Citizens United. I'm sure back in 2008 they had some other avenue that they hid the money from and did things with. But I remember, I think Obama was the first one ever to raise $1 billion, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, that's so sad.
He didn't even take public financing, so he could grab as much money as he could. And I understand, you know, that's the nature of the game. Money is, what's that great quote, Manny or Peter or John? Money is the milk of politics. Is that what it is? Or
yeah, yeah, Jesse Unruh said that.
You know, but I'm appalled because I've started to do some research when I have some free time about how much of this, did any other bars around America get money? Did any other, not that I would want to take money from the federal government, I think there's a lot of better things $25,000 could do, But, you know, it really appalled me as a taxpayer and as a bar owner in the same community. I feel betrayed.
I don't blame you.
John, I have to get your comments. You must be absolutely livid.
Real quick, Simon, let me down the Snickers bar with a sip of Big Gulp here.
And how many medications are you on right now, John? Seriously. We keep telling you, and you just take more drugs, you know? Sorry.
That was a Snickers bar, Ashley. Those are good for you, right? They're natural.
Yeah, all natural, full corn.
And, you know, take a look at the label, John. It has 54 ingredients.
Minimally.
And most of it are high fructose corn syrup. It has the most unbelievable amount of mixture.
Manny, I don't buy it to read. I buy it to eat.
Yes, I know.
And your body is reading it the way it's making you sick. So, but enjoy that bar.
John, as long as it satisfies, there's no problem.
John, when was the last time you saw the doctor about your health?
That's another matter, Manny. Let me address Simon here.
You know that old line about you are what you eat, John?
Henry Ford said about exercise, if you need it, it's too late.
John, do you think it was a rough week for Romney?
Not at all, Simon, and I was more impressed with your TV viewing. You were building to a climax there of despair. All that was missing was Elliot Spitzer.
No, Rachel Maddow.
Don't worry, Monica Lewinsky.
Here's the way I look at it, Simon, like Sam so eloquently put it earlier. Where was the outrage when Obama raised three times as much Wall Street money as McCain in 08? What about in 04 when John Kerry used the Heinz fortune to run for president? Suddenly, the money differential wasn't a problem.
We all have a problem with it then, too, John. It's no
I'm saying
different.
In most of the media, actually, you never heard about it because Republicans
well, yes,
are making an
did.
Issue.
You heard about it.
I never did, but I don't watch CNN, so...
Well,
maybe
you
Simon
don't think CNN discussed how much money he was getting from his wife in terms of Kerry?
That was constant.
Constantly.
Well,
and the newspaper
he
was
didn't
constant.
Need any contributions, man. He could just run on the Heinz fortune. But I wanted to say, Simon, as far as Romney's weak, this is just part of the political cycle. And it generally works like, and you know how it is in the media. It starts with whispering campaigns and ad hominem attacks. Nothing verified, and then it's made deafening by the commentators, the Democratic operatives in the media, and certain public figures perpetuate the myth. And it'll be over by next week, and it'll be on to something else. What have we had, a war on women, all these other various wars? Everybody's diverted from the real topic. There's people suffering out there, and it's not going to get better unless Romney gets in office.
Okay,
I have a question. And the question is this, and this one's for Peter. Peter, do you think this is a big deal with what's going on right now with the fact that he left his on the tax? I don't understand what the big deal is with him right now, the Romney's deal. Is his name is on that paper, and it goes on 2 years past what he's saying. So that, what is that about? So the stocks don't get altered or people don't lose money, yet he doesn't really, what's the company or he is with the company? Does it matter?
I'm sure it matters. I really haven't been following it. I don't know much about it. I'm a fairly apolitical person, I have to admit. Once people start talking about politics, after 2 years of working in Washington, D.C., I lose interest. So I apologize. I haven't been following all that.
All right. Okay, Manny, I'm going to ask you the question. On Friday, Romney did five interviews, bang, 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 you know, one after another, that they were all the same. He got hammered with the same questions. I sent you one of the videos. I mean, didn't you think that he was wearing a stick-on smile? I mean, he reminded me of Jack Nicholson playing the Joker in Batman.
Well, You know, I agree with Sam. Sam and I have discussed this earlier that you just should have not touched the subject. First of all, I don't think there's anything in Bain worth pursuing to even discuss. I think it's just a waste of time, in my personal opinion. But the fact isn't so much whether it's a waste of time or not. The fact is he elected to participate in this conversation, so it must have bothered him in some portion, or at least bothered his advisors, which I find interesting because one of the things that Murdoch advised him of is that he needed to get a stronger, better group of people handling his campaign for him, and I think this is another one of their mistakes. And the mistake isn't about whether it's true or not. The mistake is how bad he looked addressing the subject. And the smirk, of course, it allowed them to get into his tax returns, which I think is the real issue that hurts him. And it bothers me individually because I haven't made a decision which way I'm voting. And what bothered me about it was he's sticking the position that he's never going to release any more of his tax returns than he has, and it immediately makes me go, why? Yeah, 2 years of tax returns? I'm sorry, but I think the president, anyone running for president of the United States has a greater obligation than that. And my immediate response is, what's he hiding? And that's not a good response.
I have the exact same response, Manny.
I do too. I don't know why he doesn't just get up there and go, my tax, you can see all my tax returns from the time I was 18, whenever we first filed. And then he should say, by the way, this is my money that was at risk. I invested it with investors. I made a lot of money. I lost some money, but it wasn't the taxpayers' money. And that's what Mr. Obama's been wasting, as a lot of other politicians have been wasting. And I want to stop. I don't know. It's a simple message. My own money was at risk, not the taxpayers.
I agree.
He doesn't, and he should make his tax returns. I agree with you guys on that. And I think he's afraid that they're going to find out that he owns some piece of he had some money in a foreign bank somewhere to get a better interest rate. Not that all the other people don't do that. And he probably outsourced some jobs, as many, many other companies have, and many, many other people have, because of what I'm told, is to get away from the rules and regulations that government and Congress and state governments and local governments have put on these businesses, so they move.
Well, in his case, I don't know. First of all, I agree the best way to get rid of any problem, as Peter's pointed out, is just expose it yourself. Just get out of your life and move on. I don't agree with you on the other. And by the way, one of his concerns in my mind is that he's earned so much money that he's afraid that people are going to hold it against him. Well,
yes, I agree. That's an and I think you're right on that, Manny.
And the point is, gee whiz, if you're concerned about that, why are you running? Because we all know that Romney's made a lot of money in his life, and God bless him, he deserves every dollar of it, and he would be better off coming off as Horatio Alger saying that, look what I earned and look what I can do, instead of treating it like a negative. So instead of treating it like a positive that I would respect more, he's treating it in a way that makes me suspicious of him. But, the real issue is that companies in his time were really destroying unions and destroying the fabric of our country. And one of my complaints, and Ashley heard a client of my rail about this all the way through the 90s, that sooner or later NAFTA was going to be a horrible experience and really seriously injure this country, and it has. And what it allowed them to do was not only drive people out, create jobs, but this welfare that Romney complains about, and correctly so, he and his cronies, and in many respects, generated it. And they've generated it by those policies that are now an issue. So here he is saying that, I didn't do this, I didn't do that. Well, yes, he did, because what he did was start this ball running to build plants in Mexico to make more money, for example, which deprived middle-class Americans of jobs. And guess what? Most of those are on welfare, and most of those fit into the class warfare that John was describing a while ago. So for him to suddenly say that he's going to help people who it shows pretty clearly he not only didn't help, but sentenced them to a much more difficult life, doesn't speak well of him, and that's one of the issues that he needs to get over. I don't know if you guys agree or disagree with that, but I think that's a problem for him.
I agree.
Yeah, well, John brought up a great point. There's a lot of people are hurting out there. And this attack on Bain Capital, this attack on about contraception, whatever the issue of the flavor of the day is by the mainstream media and both parties, really does take away from what I think is the huge issue that's still out there is the housing issue. It's not really been addressed by, I think Obama's administration's been a total failure on trying to fix that. Their programs have not worked along. They haven't punished the banks. There was that big buyout of all the banks that were crooked in foreclosing on people and robo-signing and all that, and they all wrote a check to each state, and each state's so happy they got their money, and now they can go misspend that money. And meanwhile, the housing's stock, the housing is going on. No one's fixed it. And I blame that to me, is, I don't hear what Romney's plan is about it, and I know what Obama's is to do nothing.
Well, by the way, let me register one of my serious complaints about everything in this country. Every time we see one of these situations where victims are hurt like that and the government sues, where does the money go? It goes into the government coffers, and not one victim sees one dime of that money, not one dime. And that just irritates me beyond all description. So what are we doing for the victims? What's the government doing for the victims? Absolutely nothing.
Well, I agree. It's terrible. There was a huge settlement, and right, you're right, it went to the government coffers for them to spend it. Meanwhile, I know people, you know, like, I foreclosed, had to go back to live with their family, luckily they had family to move into, worse than the Great Depression. But no one's talking about that. They don't talk about that on the shows that Simon was talking about. They go, let's talk about Mitt Romney's wealth. Let's talk about the tax returns.
And I agree.
That bothers me.
Oh, you guys are ganging up against me.
Oh, no.
I mean, I'm not ganging up on you on the issue. I do feel strongly, as does Sam, that that's one of the irritating parts of all this, is that to a great extent, the people who have been harmed most by all this are the ones getting the least amount of relief. And I just think that's horribly unfair in our country. I really do.
I mean, they could have, I mean, how much, I don't know what the settlement is for, to get billions of dollars, and the fact that, like, one penny doesn't go to anybody who was wrongfully foreclosed on is amazing to me, and as one who fought a bank, and I beat Deutsche National Bank, it was that's a whole other issue for a whole show, I'd love to share it with everybody, and I beat Deutsche with the help of a great lawyer, but I was lucky, I could afford a lawyer. I've met friends who they get the eviction notice or the foreclosure notice. They do exactly what the bank wants them to do. They run. But if you fight them, especially with what they've done and the BS that I came across and many others across the country, you can win. But then the scary part is when your own local sheriff and your own local judges are the getaway drivers for the big banks. And trying to get the foreclosures rapidly through before anybody can really expose them. That's a scary thing, too, because even when I have to deal with my local sheriff and my local judge or magistrate, who's basically taken the side of a multinational corporation from Germany over people locally, that's a scary thing, too.
I agree with you. And I want to add one thing to this because we're starting to creep up on closing time. Is this gets back to my point about Congress and what goes on with Congress, because as John and I have discussed at some length, a lot of this has to do with the dishonesty that goes on in Congress, and specifically, let's talk about countrywide loans. They finally released what's something we all suspected, is that congressmen got preferential treatment from them and to basically foster these kind of loans. Gee, I'm really shocked, aren't you? And so at the end of the day, we're back to this topic of how can we change or reform anything if basically our Congress is dishonest and are willing to take bribes to advance policies that hurt Americans. And I don't see one of them being indicted, nor I've heard any discussion that one of them may be indicted. Have you, John?
No, you know, it's also, I think it was called Friends of Angelo, right? FOA?
Mm-hmm.
Angelo Mazzella, is that his last
name? Yeah, that's
name?
Right.
That's the guy. He lives right by John, right, John?
But it was also, it's not just the Congress.
Thanks a lot,
Fanny,
Manny.
Fanny and Freddie.
Well, you live in that Tony Westlake area. You got to take the responsibility. And you're in the big bucks.
It was also Congress and the bureaucracy and the lack of oversight. Fannie and Freddie Mac were complicit too. That one guy who was Johnson was his name.
Yep.
What a crook he is! But you're right, nothing's happened. They all got golden parachutes. And then we'll take what Ashley thought, her pet peeve is the lobbyist. Then they all become, they all reinvent themselves as lobbyists.
That's exactly right. In fact, I'm looking at something from a few years ago on the Legal Times. The top 50 firms, legal firms, who actually represent, have the lobbyists themselves, they were making $7 million a year. The highest grosser of the 50 was a law firm called Akin Gump, reported $76 million in lobbying fees in that year. $76 million. That's just one company. Now, that company, you have them influencing, and as you call it, influencing, peddling in Washington with this lobbying, and they are, and many of these companies, many of them are actually have under their window, they have all these banks. So here you are with these banks, with the lobbyists, and the lobbyists are then going into D.C. and, oh, wow, didn't I say Romney just collected $100 million, and I don't know how much Obama last month? And, you know, who are they beholden to? $76 million for one company in one year.
I'm surprised Akin Gump is at the top of that list, Peter. There are others I would have suspected that would have been higher.
Well, this was a few years ago, Manny, so I couldn't find the recent one, so it may have shifted.
Okay. Well, I got to give you guys an alert. My wife just handed me a piece of paper. This is pretty funny. She's watching CNN. Okay. Hillary Clinton's in Egypt. And opening up an embassy or consulate again, because we closed it up after the mini revolution there against Mubarak. She was met with crowds that were screaming "Monica, Monica, Monica" at her. I'm serious.
I like it, and I think on that note, we are flat out of time, so I want to go round the table and get everyone's final thoughts. Peter Haven, I'll start with you. You're by far the most sensible of the crowd.
Well, that's kind of you to say. I don't think it's true, but I just really am grateful. I love hearing everybody's comments, and it definitely gives me a lot to think about, and I'm very grateful to be a part of it. Thank you.
And you can rest assured we'll be doing this again next week. Sam, your words of wisdom.
Mine, I feel like we all hang out at each other's living room. I mean, it's so comforting to be with people.
How about your bar?
Yeah, that'd be fun too. I'd love to have some beers with you guys. I find it very very stimulating and interesting, and all of you people have such wonderful views, and it's great that we agree to disagree, and we do it in the way it was supposed to meant, when good civil discourse. And I wish everybody has a great Sunday and a beautiful week this week.
Super. And my favorite nemesis, John Perry. I mean, John, I always love talking to you.
You say that with such sincerity, I'm moved. A couple things. You guys are killing me. You talk about wanting to see Mitt Romney's tax returns. Our current Treasury Secretary, head of the IRS, Tiny Tim Geithner, filed erroneous tax returns, guy in charge of the IRS. That apparently is lost on a lot of people. And Simon, some advice to you when you're watching CNN. I read this about 30 years ago in Burr by Gore Vidal. Liberals are as quick to abandon principle when it suits them as they are to condemn others for that same absence of principle. Keep that in mind when you're watching those propaganda stations.
I certainly will.
And a liberal said that, Gore Vidal.
Ashley, I want to thank you for joining us. Do you have any parting words for us?
Normally I do, but I'm now speechless. I would like to thank you for all of you for allowing me to come on today. I appreciate it, and it's been very interesting and thought-provoking, and I do appreciate the time. Thank you, Simon. Thank you, Nina.
Oh, you're more than welcome, and you're welcome any day. You're much less provocative than John.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Stop pandering to my wife.
And Manny, thank you for taking part. You must have a quick rant for us.
Oh, I have one every morning for breakfast. but seriously, we're going to go on with this. We have approximately 15 weeks before the election, and we're going to go through this over and over. Not the same issues, but the basic topics of our country, the corruption in it, the corruption in those particular areas, the actions of the multinational corporations, the universities. And this is not a Democratic or Republican issue. Both parties contribute too much money. Both wealthy individuals in both categories contribute to their causes. What we have is a nation out of control that needs to get back into control. Too often I hear the conservatives say to me, we're morally and ethically out of control, and they're thinking more about issues like abortion and all the rest of it. But this is the real issue that we all have to grapple with. We need to grapple with how do we want our country run ethically. And as John points out, many of these things evidence the moral and ethical decline of our country. And we as a nation must simply start dealing with that moral and ethical decline. It's rotted out our schools. It's rotted out the rest of our institutions. We have corporations we can't rely on, we can't trust. We have criminals running our streets. We have pandemonium in cities like Chicago, a civil unrest going everywhere, and we need to stop and deal with this. We need to look at the bigger causes, and the bigger causes are always bribery, corruption, the lack of control over government, and what goes on in basically the Senate and the House. And until we cure the Senate and the House, as I pointed out earlier, this election may not have a great deal of meaning. So join our show every week while we get into these issues, and it's time for some of the people to call in and jump in and express some of their views, since we know there's a wide variety of different views across our country, and we want to hear them from people. And hopefully we've added something to your life. Hopefully we've made you think about issues. On John's side, who has the most conservative comments that I make jokes about, John and I have lunch regularly. We discuss this regularly. We exchange views like gentlemen. We hug each other. We laugh at the end. And that's what America needs. Stop this vitriolistic approach to every single issue in our country. Not every issue is something we're going to die for and fight to the death over, because that's essentially what caused the Civil War and why I made that observation opening this. So let's all work together. Let's have open discourse. Let's try and communicate the way we have on this show. Hopefully we're setting an example for everybody. And come back next week. It's more of the same, but it'll be totally different at the same time. Thank you.
Absolutely. I want to thank everyone for taking part today. It was a great discussion. And I think Sam Moffey hit it on the head. It's just like sitting around a table having a talk. So to all of our listeners, we want to thank you, and we wish you a happy and safe week. And please join us again next week, and we'll be back just as bad. Till then, goodbye.